Welcome to your deep dive on large language models, LLMs.
LLMs.
Yeah, it looks like you've been digging into all kinds of stuff from like the basics of how they process language to that crazy world of multimodal models. You've given us a ton of research here, a mountain to climb, and I am so ready to explore it with you. It seems like you're really trying to get a handle on not just what they can do, but how these LLMs are like right on the edge of changing everything.
It really is quite a journey, going from these basic algorithms that could barely understand a simple sentence to these models that can write novels, translate languages, even write code.
Okay, so let's unpack this a little bit. One thing I've always kind of gotten hung up on is how these things actually, quote unquote, understand language. It's not like there's a dictionary in their little digital brains, right?
Think about it. Traditional language processing was kind of like trying to listen to a symphony, but listening to each instrument in isolation. You might recognize the individual notes, but you'd miss the melody, the harmony, the emotion of the whole piece.
Right, you lose the whole picture.
Totally.
So how did we even bridge that gap? I've got this paper here. Attention is all you need. Was that a turning point?
Absolutely. That was a game changer.
Really?
Introduced the concept of attention, which allows the model to weigh
Good.
the importance of different words in a sentence,
Okay.
even those far apart.
Got it.
It's like it's reading with laser focus, zeroing in
Oh, wow.
on the most relevant parts to grasp the context.
So instead of looking at words in isolation, it's more like it's considering how they all sort of relate to each other, almost like how we do as humans.
Think of it like this. Imagine you're reading a mystery novel. You don't just focus on the last sentence. You're piecing together clues from earlier, remembering character relationships, building a mental model of the whole story.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Attention allows LLMs to do something similar.
Wow. So it's looking at the big picture, not just those individual words. This ability to kind of understand relationships across longer stretches of text. That seems like such a key reason why LLMs are so powerful. They're finally seeing the forest for the trees.
That's a great way to put it.
And this brings us to the transformer architecture, which is like, what, the engine behind all this?
It's incredibly efficient at handling those long-range dependencies, and it scales beautifully.
So when people talk about like scaling LLMs, is that basically what they're talking about? Just making the models bigger and giving them.
Well, that's a big part of it. The size of an LLM is often measured in parameters, which you can think of as connections between
Got it.
the artificial neurons in the model. And in many ways, size does matter. Larger models with more parameters tend to perform better.
That makes sense. So I'm looking at models here, like GPT-3, GPT-4, Llama 3, Gemini. Are those just.
They're all based on the transformer architecture, but they have different sizes and strengths. Another important factor is the context window.
What's that?
Think of it as the LLM's short-term memory. The bigger the window, the more information it can hold in mind at once.
Got it.
GPT-3 has a window of about 2049 tokens.
Tokens.
Think words are parts of words, but GPT-4 and Gemini boast a whopping 128,000.
That's a huge jump.
It is.
Okay, so that's like going from a short story to a whole encyclopedia in terms of how much they can process. But wouldn't that also make it
It does.
super resource intensive?
Absolutely. Training these massive models requires incredible computational power.
Wow, so it's like trying to simulate
That's it.
an entire universe on a computer.
It's a huge challenge.
So how do we even begin to train an LLM? I mean, how do you teach something that complex to even understand language in the first place?
Well, there are a few key techniques. One is called masked language modeling. Imagine taking a sentence and randomly blanking out some words. The LLM's job is to figure out those missing words based on the surrounding context.
Got it.
It's like a giant superpowered game of fill in the blanks.
So it's playing Mad Libs?
Basically,
Oh,
yes.
okay.
And it forces the model to really grasp the nuances of language.
So by doing this, it starts to pick up on the patterns of how words are used and how they relate to each other.
Exactly.
It's like learning grammar and vocabulary by osmosis.
Exactly.
Cool. Okay.
And then there's another technique called autoregressive language modeling, where the LLM learns to predict the next word in a sequence. This is how we train models to generate text.
Okay.
One word at a time.
Got it.
It's like giving it a writing prompt.
Okay.
And letting it take the reins, compose the rest of the story.
So you have those two kind of main methods.
Yeah.
One focused on understanding language, the other one on generating it.
Exactly.
But I can't imagine it's that straightforward.
It's not.
What are the challenges that come up?
Well, one big one is handling words.
Okay.
The LLM has never seen before.
Okay.
Think about all the new words and slang that pop up every day.
Right. Yeah. Language is always evolving.
Exactly.
So what happens when the LLM hits a word it doesn't know?
Yeah.
Does it just crash?
Well, that's where a technique called subword tokenization comes in.
Okay.
Instead of treating words as these indivisible units, we break them down into smaller parts.
Okay.
Think about the word unhappiness.
Okay. Unhappiness.
A traditional model might get stuck if it's never seen that exact word before.
Okay.
But with subword tokenization,
okay,
it can recognize the parts,
okay,
unhappy and evidentness, and figure out the meaning from those building blocks.
So it's like sounding it out.
It is.
Like we learned to do as kids.
Exactly.
Very cool.
Yeah, and this is especially important for languages that have complex morphology, where words can be combined in many different ways.
So with subword tokenization, the LLM becomes much more adaptable.
Exactly.
It's not thrown off by unfamiliar words as much.
Right. It's like giving it a linguistic tool to handle any situation.
I like that a lot, but we're still dealing with these absolute massive models.
Yes.
They take so much computing power and memory.
That's one of the biggest challenges.
Yeah.
Even with techniques like subword tokenization, these models can be incredibly resource intensive.
So how do we even make them accessible?
Yeah.
Like what if somebody wants to run an LLM on their phone or their laptop? Not everybody has a supercomputer in their basement.
Yeah, that's where quantization comes in.
Okay, what's that?
It's a way to compress the model, making it smaller and more efficient without sacrificing too much accuracy.
So it's like zipping a file.
Yeah, kind of.
Shrinking it down to email it to someone.
Exactly.
How do you even shrink something as complex as an LLM?
Well, think of it like this.
Okay.
The model's weights.
Yeah.
The numbers that determine how it processes information.
Okay.
They're usually stored in a high precision format.
Okay.
Like a super detailed photograph.
Okay.
Quantization reduces the precision, kind of like converting that photograph to a lower resolution.
Right.
You lose some detail.
Okay.
But the overall picture is still recognizable.
So you're trying to find that sweet spot between size and accuracy.
Right.
You make the model small enough to run on a regular device.
Yeah.
But it's still got all the smarts.
Right.
Are there different ways to do that?
There are. There's symmetric quantization.
Okay.
Where we center the weights around zero.
Okay.
And then scale them down. It's simple and effective.
Got it.
And then there's asymmetric quantization.
Okay.
Which is a bit more sophisticated.
Okay.
Takes into account the range of values in the weights.
Okay.
And scales them accordingly.
So they both aim to kind of shrink the model.
Yes.
But without sacrificing too much performance.
Exactly.
It's like choosing different compression algorithms for different files.
Exactly.
You know, some are good for images.
Right.
Some are better for audio.
Right.
And then there's also, when you do it, post-training quantization or quantization-aware training.
Yes.
So it's like deciding whether to pack your suitcase before you leave.
Right.
Or just shove everything in at the last minute.
That's a great way to put it.
One's a lot more planning.
Yeah.
But it might be more efficient in the long run.
Exactly. Post-training quantization is simpler, but you might lose some accuracy.
Okay.
Quantization-aware training can preserve more accuracy.
Okay.
But it's more complex.
Okay.
And resource-intensive.
So it's always this trade-off between performance and efficiency.
It is.
But I think it's so cool how all these researchers are figuring out all these clever ways to make these powerful models available to everybody.
Yeah, it's a constantly evolving field with new techniques and breakthroughs all the time.
This is mind-blowing already.
Yeah.
And we've only just touched the surface.
We have.
We have so much more to explore.
Yes.
From fine-tuning these models for specific tasks to this whole world of retrieval augmented generation where LLMs can actually tap into external knowledge bases to become even more powerful.
Exactly. We've got a lot more to unpack.
I am ready.
I am ready to dive deeper.
Let's do it. We'll be back right after this.
Okay.
To continue your deep dive into the fascinating world of LLMs.
Great.
See you in a bit.
So before the break, we were talking about how to make these powerful LLMs more accessible.
Right.
But even with those techniques, there's still these vast, complex systems.
They are.
So how do we shape them? How do we train them to be truly useful for specific tasks?
It's one thing to have an LLM that can understand and generate language, but how do we take it to the next level?
Yeah.
How do we make it an expert in a particular domain?
Exactly.
Like writing code or summarizing medical research.
That's where fine-tuning comes in.
Okay.
Think of it like taking a brilliant student who's mastered the basics and then giving them specialized training to become a doctor, a lawyer, a poet.
Right.
We're guiding the LLM to excel in a specific area.
So I'm seeing some notes here about different types of fine tuning.
Uh-huh.
One is called supervised fine tuning.
Right.
Or SFT. Yeah. What's that all about?
SFT is all about giving the LLM clear examples to learn from. Imagine showing it a bunch of flashcards with questions on one side, answers on the other.
Got it.
It learns to map between those inputs and outputs,
gradually
getting better at answering those specific types of questions.
So it's like training a dog with treats.
Kind of, yeah.
You know, it gives the right answer, it gets rewarded,
right,
and it wants to repeat that behavior.
Exactly.
But are there situations where you don't have those clear-cut right answers?
There are.
Okay.
Sometimes the desired output is more nuanced, more subjective.
Okay.
That's where reinforcement learning from human feedback, or RLHF, comes into play.
RLHF.
Yeah. A bit more complex.
Yeah.
But incredibly powerful.
So what's the basic idea there?
With RLHF, we bring in the human touch.
Okay.
We have people evaluate the LLM's output, giving it feedback, like, that's a great response, or this could be more helpful. That feedback is then used to train a separate reward model, which then guides the LLM towards generating outputs that are more aligned with human preferences.
So it's like having a teacher.
It is.
Who's not just grading your work, but giving you like personalized feedback on how to improve.
Right. And this is especially useful for things like chatbots, conversational AI, where you want systems that can understand what we're saying.
Totally.
But also respond in a way that feels natural and engaging.
We want them to pass the Turing test.
Exactly.
Make us feel like we're talking to a person, not a machine.
Exactly.
But even with all this training and fine-tuning, we still need a way to communicate with these LLMs.
You do.
Effectively guide them towards the specific outcomes we want.
Yes.
Which is where prompt engineering comes in.
Exactly.
Which I've seen everywhere, but still feels a bit mysterious to me.
Yeah.
So what is prompt engineering?
It's like learning to speak the LLM's language.
Okay.
Crafting the perfect input to elicit the desired response.
So it's not just like giving it a command.
Right.
Like, write me a poem about cats.
No, it's much more nuanced than that.
Good. There's more to it.
Much more.
So how do we do it?
Think of it like this.
Okay.
You wouldn't walk into a Michelin star restaurant.
Okay.
And just say, give me food.
Right.
You'd be specific about your preferences.
Yeah.
The cuisine you're in the mood for.
Right.
Any dietary restrictions.
I get it.
Prompt engineering is similar.
Okay.
It's about providing the LLM with the right context, the right guidance to steer it in the right direction.
Okay, so give me the chef's tasting menu of prompting.
All right, well, there's zero-shot learning, where we challenge the LLM to perform a task without any specific examples.
Oh, wow.
It's like saying, hey, you're a smart cookie, figure this out.
So you're testing its ability to generalize.
It's from its existing knowledge.
Right.
See if it can connect the dots on its own.
Yes.
Okay, cool. Then there's one-shot learning.
Okay.
Where we provide just one example.
Okay.
To give it a nudge in the right direction. And few-shot learning.
Okay.
Where we give a handful of examples to really demonstrate the pattern we're after.
So it's like showing a kid how to tie their shoes.
It is.
You do it a few times.
Right.
And then they start to get it.
Exactly.
But are there ways to go even deeper than that?
There are.
Okay.
Like, to understand how it's actually thinking, there are. One technique is called chain of thought prompting.
Okay.
Where we encourage the LLM to explain its reasoning process step by step.
Okay.
It's like asking a student to show their work.
Oh, okay.
Not just give the final answer.
Got it.
This helps us understand the logic behind the responses and make sure it's not just making lucky guesses.
So we're trying to peek under the hood a little bit.
Yeah, we are.
And that helps us to improve the model.
Absolutely.
Right, cool.
And then there's iterative prompting.
Okay.
Where we refine the prompt based on the initial responses.
Got it.
It's like having a conversation with the model back and forth, gradually shaping the output towards what we want.
It's like collaborating on a writing project.
It is.
You know, you're bouncing ideas back and forth, refining each other's thoughts.
Exactly.
And you end up with something better than either of you could have done alone.
Yes.
But with all this talk about training and prompting, it seems like we're assuming these LLMs always get things right.
Yeah.
What about those moments when they hallucinate?
Yeah, that's a crucial point.
You know, they confidently produce information.
Yeah.
That's just plain wrong.
That's one of the biggest challenges.
Yeah.
LLMs are powerful, but they're not perfect.
Right.
It can generate outputs that are factually incorrect.
Right. It's not even nonsensical.
It's like they're telling us a tall tale, but with absolute conviction.
Right. And that can be dangerous.
Yeah, if people take that as fact.
Exactly.
So what are researchers doing about that?
Well, one approach is to improve the quality of the training data.
Okay.
If a student learns from outdated textbooks, they might spout outdated information.
Right.
An LLM trained on biased or inaccurate data might generate biased or inaccurate outputs.
That makes sense.
So ensuring that training data is diverse, balanced, factually accurate is crucial.
It's like making sure it has access to the best library in the world from, you know, reliable sources, multiple perspectives.
Absolutely.
But even with the best data, LLMs can still make mistakes.
They can.
So are there other safeguards in place?
There are.
Okay.
Researchers are exploring ways to incorporate human oversight into the development process.
Using human evaluators to identify and correct hallucinations.
Oh, it's like having fact checkers for AI.
Exactly. To make sure the information's accurate.
Got it.
Reliable.
Is that happening in real time?
Not necessarily in real time.
Okay.
But the idea is to have a system where human feedback is continuously integrated into the training and evaluation process.
So it's like a safety net under a tightrope walker.
It is. Yeah. Even if they stumble,
there's
a system in place to prevent a catastrophic fall.
Okay, I like that.
Yeah.
But we've been talking about all these high-level concepts.
Right.
I want to zoom in on something specific.
Okay.
Tokenization.
Yeah.
I'm still a little fuzzy on that.
Okay.
What is it?
Tokenization is a fundamental step in how LLMs process language.
Okay.
It's like translating a novel into a code that a LLM can understand.
Okay.
It's the bridge between human language and the numerical world of computers.
So instead of feeding the LLM raw text, we break it down into these little units.
We do. We call them tokens.
Tokens.
Yes.
And what are the different approaches?
So there are different approaches to tokenization, each with its pros and cons.
Okay.
Word-based tokenization is the simplest.
Okay.
We just split the text into individual words.
Okay.
But this can lead to a huge vocabulary.
Right. Especially for languages.
Especially.
With complex morphology, where you can make these long compound words.
Exactly.
Okay.
And then there's character-based tokenization, which breaks down the text into individual characters.
Okay.
This gives you a much smaller vocabulary.
Okay.
But you lose a lot of the context and meaning that's encoded at the word level.
It's like trying to understand a sentence.
It is.
By just looking at the letters.
Exactly.
Right.
You might get the basic sounds, but you'd miss the bigger picture.
Right.
That's why subword tokenization has become so popular. It tries to find a balance by breaking down words into smaller, more meaningful units that are still frequent enough to be manageable.
So it's like the Goldilocks zone of tokenization.
It is.
Not too big, not too small.
Exactly. Right. And there are different algorithms for achieving this balance.
Okay.
Each with its own strengths and weaknesses.
Got it.
One popular one is called byte pair encoding.
Okay.
Or BPE. It starts with individual characters.
Okay.
And then iteratively merges the most frequent pairs into longer subwords.
So it's like a linguistic Lego set.
It is, yeah.
You start with the basic building blocks,
uh-huh,
and then you can make more complex things.
Exactly.
Oh, okay.
Another technique is WordPiece, similar to BPE, but uses a slightly different scoring mechanism
okay.
to choose the best merges.
Okay.
And then there's sentence piece,
okay.
which has the advantage of being language agnostic.
Oh, wow.
Meaning it can be used for any language
okay.
without modification.
So it's like a universal translator for tokenization.
Exactly.
But with all this talk about breaking down words,
yeah.
how does the LLM understand what those tokens mean?
That's where embeddings come in.
Okay, what are those?
Embeddings are like a secret code
okay.
that unlocks the meaning of words for the LLM.
So break the code for me. What are they?
Think of an embedding as a point
okay.
in a multidimensional space.
Okay.
Each word or token is assigned a unique point
okay.
in this space.
Okay.
And words with similar meanings are clustered
okay.
closer together.
So it's like a map.
It is.
Of the semantic relationship.
Exactly. Well, right. So cat and dog would be close together
okay.
because they're both furry, four-legged animals.
Right.
But cat and airplane
yeah.
would be further apart because they're completely different concepts.
They have nothing to do with each other.
Exactly.
So.
And embeddings capture not only the literal meaning of words,
okay.
but also their contextual nuances,
okay.
their emotional connotations,
got it.
Even their grammatical roles in a sentence.
It's like every word has a fingerprint.
It does.
A unique set of characteristics.
Exactly.
And these embeddings allow the LLM
yeah.
to not just recognize words,
right.
but understand their meaning.
Exactly.
But how they relate to each other.
Right. So tokenization breaks down the text.
Yeah.
And embeddings give those units meaning.
Okay.
It's a two-step process.
Got it.
That unlocks the power of language for the LLM.
So we've talked a lot about text.
We have.
What about other modalities?
Yeah.
Like images or audio? Can LLMs handle those too?
That's a great question.
Yeah.
And it brings us to the exciting world of multimodal models.
Multimodal.
These are LLMs that can process and understand
okay.
different types of data,
yeah.
not just text. One example is vision transformers.
Vision transformers.
Which adapt the transformer architecture
okay.
to image processing.
So instead of feeding it words,
yeah.
we're feeding it images.
Well, not exactly.
Yep.
We don't feed it the whole image at once.
Okay.
Instead, we break down the image
okay.
into smaller patches.
Got it.
Kind of like subword tokenization for text.
Uh-huh.
Each patch is treated like a word
okay.
and processed by the transformer self-attention mechanisms.
So the LLM is learning to see.
In a way, yes.
By understanding the relationship
exactly.
between different parts of an image.
Yeah.
Just like it understands language.
Exactly.
By looking at the relationship between words.
Precisely.
Very cool.
And this has opened up a whole new range of possibilities.
Like what?
From generating captions for images to identifying objects.
Uh-huh.
Even creating entirely new images from text descriptions.
So like it's developing a whole new set of senses.
It is.
Wow.
Going beyond language.
Yeah.
To perceive and interact with the world.
Very cool.
And then there are models like CLEP. It stands for Contrastive Language Image Pre-training.
What's that do?
It can understand and connect both image and text data.
So it's like a translator between those two worlds.
That's a great way to put it.
Cool.
CLIP learns to match images
okay.
with their corresponding text descriptions.
Okay.
This allows it to do things like image retrieval.
Okay.
Imagine searching for images using natural language queries.
That's very cool.
Or zero-shot classification.
Okay.
Where you can classify images into categories that oh. the model has never seen before.
So it's learning to see the world
yeah.
through both eyes and words.
Exactly.
And by connecting those two,
right.
it's getting a deeper understanding of both.
Exactly.
These are just a few examples
yeah.
of how researchers are pushing the boundaries.
It's a rapidly evolving field.
Yeah.
We're only just beginning to tap into the full potential.
It's already so much.
It is.
I'm overwhelmed.
Yeah.
But before we go too far,
okay.
I think we should revisit
sure.
some of the fundamental building blocks
okay.
of word embeddings.
Okay, yeah.
We've talked about how they capture the meaning of words.
Right.
But how are they actually created?
Well, there are various techniques
okay.
for creating word embeddings.
Okay.
Each based on this idea
okay.
that words appearing in similar contexts
okay.
tend to have similar meanings.
Makes sense.
One classic method is called word-to-vec.
Word-to-vec.
Which uses a neural network to learn these relationships.
Could you refresh my memory
sure.
on how that works?
Imagine you're reading a sentence.
Okay.
And you want to predict the next word.
Okay.
Word2Vec looks at the surrounding words.
Okay.
The context
okay.
tries to guess what comes next.
Got it.
By doing this over and over again
okay.
with massive amounts of text,
yeah.
it learns to represent words as vectors.
Okay.
lists of numbers that capture their meaning and relationship to other words.
So it's basically playing a giant game of Mad Libs.
Yeah, it's a good way to think about it.
Okay.
And through that process, it starts to understand the connections between words.
Got it.
And then there's another technique called GLOVE.
GLOVE.
Which stands for Global Vectors for Word Representation.
Okay.
Which takes a slightly different approach. Instead of looking at word sequences, it creates a matrix that counts how often words appear together in a large corpus of text.
So it's taking this massive spreadsheet of word relationships and distilling it down into something more manageable.
Yes.
Okay.
Both Word2Vec and GLOVE have been super influential.
Okay.
But they have a key limitation.
What's that?
They generate static embeddings.
Okay, and what does that mean?
It means that each word
gets
a single fixed representation,
regardless
of the context.
Oh.
So the word bank would have the same embedding, whether you're talking about a financial institution or a riverbank.
Right, context is everything.
Exactly. That's why contextual embeddings have become so important.
Right.
Models like BERT, which stands for Bidirectional Encoder Representations from Transformers, generate embeddings that are sensitive to the surrounding context.
So the embedding for a bank would change depending on if it's next to money or river.
Exactly.
So it's like words have multiple personalities.
Yeah, think of it that way.
You know, different ways of expressing themselves depending on who they're hanging out with.
Exactly.
And BERT can capture those subtle shifts in meaning.
BERT can, and it's trained on massive amounts of text.
Okay.
Using techniques like masked language modeling and next sentence prediction, where it learns to predict whether two sentences are likely to follow each other.
So it's not just learning the vocabulary.
Right.
It's learning the grammar.
Exactly.
The syntax.
Yeah.
How ideas flow.
That's exactly.
BERT is getting a much deeper, richer understanding of how language actually works.
That's right.
Cool.
And this is what allows it to perform so well on such a wide range of language tasks.
Like what?
Question answering.
Okay.
Sentiment analysis.
Uh-huh.
Machine translation.
Wow.
It's a major leap forward.
It's incredible how much goes into
it is
building and training these powerful LLMs.
Yeah.
It's not just feeding them data and letting them run wild.
It's not.
There's a lot of tweaking, fine-tuning involved.
Absolutely. One crucial aspect is hyperparameter tuning.
Hyperparameter tuning.
These are the knobs and dials that control how the LLM learns, like the learning rate, the batch size, the number of training epochs.
Okay.
Getting these settings right can make a huge difference.
So it's like tuning a musical instrument.
It is.
And you get to adjust the strings, the tuning pegs.
Exactly.
The tension to get that perfect sound.
Right. And with techniques like Lore, which we discussed earlier, we have even more hyperparameters to tune, like the rank and alpha values.
Okay.
Getting those right can significantly impact the model's expressiveness.
Okay.
Adaptability.
It's like having a whole orchestra of parameters.
It is.
To adjust.
Yeah.
Each one contributing to the overall
harmony of the LLM.
I like that.
And we're not just fine-tuning its knowledge.
Right.
We're shaping its personality, its style, its creativity.
Wow. We can even control the randomness of the output.
Like adjusting the temperature parameter.
Temperature.
Yeah. Higher temperature leads to more diverse creative results.
Okay.
While a lower temperature makes it more predictable.
So it's like choosing between a jazz musician who improvises freely.
Right.
And a classical pianist who plays from the score.
Exactly.
And you can kind of tailor that.
It can.
To fit the specific task or creative goal.
Right. And then there are techniques.
Okay.
Like top K sampling.
Okay.
Which limits the sampling pool to the top K most probable tokens.
Got it.
This can improve the quality of the generated text.
Okay.
By reducing the chances of it producing nonsensical or irrelevant outputs.
So you're giving it a little bit of guidance.
Yeah, like a gentle nudge.
The gentle nudge.
To keep it on track.
Okay.
Prevent it from going off on a tangent.
All these fine-tuning techniques are essential for getting the most out of LLMs.
Absolutely.
But evaluating the performance of these LLMs.
Yeah.
I imagine that's a whole other beast.
It is. It's complex. It's not just about checking for grammatically correct sentences.
It's about whether it can tell a story.
Exactly.
Make an argument.
Right.
Answer a question in a way that's informative and engaging.
That's right.
So what are some of the key metrics?
Well, one is perplexity.
Okay.
which measures how well the LLM predicts the next word.
So it's like a measure of its fluency.
It is.
How smoothly it's generating text.
Exactly.
Okay.
And then there's faithfulness.
Faithfulness.
Which measures how well its output aligns.
Okay.
With the source material.
Got it.
Especially for things like summarization or translation.
So it's not just paraphrasing or rewriting.
It's about capturing the essence of the original.
Okay.
Preserving its meaning and intent.
Okay.
And relevancy.
Okay.
Is another crucial one,
yeah.
Especially for question answering.
Oh, well.
We want to make sure
yeah.
that the response actually addresses the question
right.
and doesn't go off on a tangent.
So it's not just about sounding good.
Right.
It's about being useful.
Exactly.
Informative, relevant.
Right. And then there are task-specific metrics
okay.
like BLEU and Rouge,
okay.
which are used for evaluating machine translation,
okay.
text summarization.
Got it.
These metrics compare the LLM's output
okay.
to a reference translation or summary. Assess how well they align.
So it's like a grading rubric.
It is.
For LLMs.
Yeah.
A way to objectively measure their performance.
Exactly.
But all this talk about performance and metrics
yeah.
makes me think about the hardware and infrastructure.
Absolutely.
That you need to even train and run these massive models.
You're right.
It's not like you can just fire up an LLM on your laptop.
No, you can't.
But how do we even do it?
Training LLMs, especially the big ones,
yeah.
requires significant computational power.
Okay.
And that brings us to yep. GPU parallelization techniques.
Okay, GPUs, those are like graphics cards
yeah.
that gamers use.
They are.
What role do they play in LLM training?
GPUs are specialized hardware
okay.
designed for parallel processing,
okay.
meaning they can perform many calculations simultaneously.
Okay.
And this ability to crunch numbers in parallel
okay.
is essential for training LLMs,
okay.
which involve these massive matrix operations.
So it's like having a whole team of workers instead of just one person doing the job.
Exactly.
But how do you coordinate all those workers,
yeah.
all those GPUs, to work together effectively?
That's where parallelization techniques come in.
Okay.
There are several approaches,
yeah.
each with its pros and cons.
Okay.
One is data parallelism,
okay.
where we split the training data
okay.
across multiple GPUs.
Okay.
Each GPU gets a copy of the model
okay.
and trains on a different subset of the data.
So it's like splitting up a giant jigsaw puzzle.
Yeah, it's a great analogy.
Give each worker a different section to assemble.
Exactly.
And then you put it all together at the end.
Right, and then there's model parallelism,
all right.
where we split the model itself
okay.
across multiple GPUs.
Okay.
Different parts of the model are placed on different GPUs.
Okay.
And they communicate with each other
okay.
to complete the training process.
So it's like an assembly line.
It is.
Each worker specializes in one step.
Exactly.
And then passes it on to the next.
Right.
Wow. This is fascinating.
And there are even more sophisticated techniques.
Like
tensor parallelism and pipeline parallelism.
Okay.
Which involve splitting individual tensors or stages of the model.
Okay.
Across multiple GPUs.
So it sounds like a whole other science.
It is. It's complex.
Yeah.
But luckily, there are some fantastic libraries available.
Like what?
Like DeepSpeed and Megatron LM.
Okay.
Which provide pre-built tools and optimizations
okay.
for large-scale model training.
So they're handling a lot of that complexity for us?
They are, behind the scenes,
okay.
allowing researchers to focus on building and fine-tuning the models.
It's like having a team of expert engineers helping you build this AI engine.
Exactly.
So beyond parallelization techniques,
right.
are there other tips and best practices for optimizing LLM training?
There are. One common technique is mixed precision training.
Okay.
Where we use a lower precision format,
yeah.
like FP16.
FP16.
For some computation, while still using higher precision for others.
Okay.
This can reduce memory usage and speed up training
but,
without sacrificing too much accuracy.
So it's like using the right tool for the job.
Exactly.
You know, sometimes you need a scalpel.
Right.
Sometimes a hammer will do.
Right. You don't always need the highest precision.
Okay.
And another technique is activation checkpointing.
Okay. What's that?
During training, the activations, the outputs of different layers in the model,
okay.
they consume a lot of memory.
Okay.
Activation checkpointing only saves some of these activations
okay.
and recomputes others when needed.
Okay.
This reduces memory usage.
Okay.
But it increases computation time.
Okay.
It's a trade-off.
Got it.
But it can be essential for very large models.
It's like strategically caching the most important info.
It is.
And then recomputing the rest later.
Exactly.
If you need it.
Right.
you're optimizing the use of your limited resources.
That's a great way to put it.
And then there's zero.
Zero.
Which stands for?
Zero redundancy optimizer.
Okay, what does that do?
It's a memory optimization technique that partitions the model states, including optimizer states, gradients, and parameters across multiple GPUs.
So it's like having a distributed storage system.
It is.
For the LLM's brain.
That's a great analogy.
Spreading the information out makes it more manageable.
Exactly. These are just a few of the tricks to make LLM training more efficient and scalable.
This is mind-blowing.
It's a constantly evolving field.
Yeah.
We're always looking for new and better ways
uh-huh.
to push the boundaries of what's possible.
This has been such a whirlwind tour.
It has.
Of LLM training and optimization.
Yeah.
I'm so impressed by all the ingenuity and technical skill that goes into creating these models.
It's a fascinating field.
It is.
And it's only getting more exciting.
Yeah.
As we explore new architectures, new training techniques, and new applications.
This has been incredible. Thank you so much for walking me through.
It's been my pleasure.
All of this.
Yeah, it's been fun.
And to our listeners, thank you for joining us on this deep dive.
Yeah, thanks for listening.
Into the world of LLMs.
We hope you learned a lot.
We hope you've learned a lot and gained a deeper understanding of these powerful models.
Absolutely.
And how they're shaping our world.
It's an exciting time.
Keep learning. Keep exploring.
Yes.
Keep asking questions.
And maybe you'll be the one
to
make the next groundbreaking discovery.
That's what I'm hoping for.
Yeah. Push the boundaries of what's possible.
Absolutely. Until next time, keep diving deep.